Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken toll, we ducked inside the doorways, thunder went crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sounds, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activities, in the former Soviet Union. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And yesterday there was a ceremony with the president, introduced by Elie Wiesel, at the National Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., where the president talked about this new board that he set out, the Atrocities Prevention Board. Today, of course, is the commemoration of the Armenian Genocide. And the issue of responsibility to protect has come up. It would seem to me that perhaps working on the inside at the White House, people like Samantha Power have actually had some influence in getting this board set up and getting them a seat on the National Security Council. You follow intimately what's going on in Washington. What's your reading on what's going on here with R2P?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, Samantha has been an advocate of this issue as long as she's been writing. I mean, she started as a journalist covering it and advocating the need for a restructuring of government to be sure that atrocity crimes and genocide issues were more systematically addressed, effectively, so that there would be no repetition of what happened in Rwanda, for instance. And this particular proposal of a genocide prevention board has been floated around for some time. I mean, certainly I could find it being mentioned and discussed back in 2007, 2008. So I think this marks a realization of something that's been in gestation for several years.
And her husband's an important advisor there as well, right?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think, moreover, if you look at Obama's presidency, we can see a number of cases in which these dynamics have played an important role in national security policymaking. I mean, certainly last year we had Libya, in which the notion of responsibility to protect, accusations that Gaddafi was proceeding with genocidal intent towards his own population, played heavily in producing an about-face by Barack Obama. He had essentially made a decision not to engage in Libya, and in the course of just a few days, he flipped around. And we know, of course, that Samantha Power and Hillary Clinton and a handful of others, Susan Rice, were critical in that decision, and that, in fact, the Pentagon and most of the national security apparatus was on the other side. So that's one case. And then currently, we see with what's going on in Syria right now, the same sort of issues being raised and pressed. And I think, this is an effort to deal in a more institutional way with those sorts of questions. But I'd also say it's not without its controversy. So there's certainly a lot of people in the human rights community who questioned pretty severely what was done in Libya. There are critics who say that, there was a pretext here of a responsibility to protect and genocide prevention, but what was really going on was regime change, that things flipped within a matter of weeks, and that the U.S. and its NATO allies were involved in very aggressive actions that resulted in the suppression and indeed ultimately the death of Muammar Gaddafi.
Well, that, of course, resonates with those that support the Syrian regime, particularly the Russians. Of course, Hugo Chavez and others, Chavez is actually keeping their oil lifeline open. So there is, and I suppose in some elements in the European left is also believe that R2P is a screen that the evil empire, the American empire, is using to further its nefarious activities.
Yeah, I wouldn't say just the European left. I mean, I'd say an awful lot of people actually inside the United Nations Secretariat sort of raise an eyebrow and say it's hard to discern sometimes when it's a real R2P operation and when it's the Americans using this as cover for something else, for a regime change operation.
Right. But don't you think, Scott, this is a very naive conversation? Because let's face it, there is a resource war going on in the world. And my understanding of why the United States intervened in Libya was entirely to do with the fact that had Gaddafi been able to murder all of the opposition, he would have then been in power, been a pariah state. The only people who would deal with him would be the Russians and the Chinese, all of whom would make all the oil deals. The Europeans and the Americans would be cut out. The same thing is happening in Burma or Myanmar. We've managed to make inroads into the Burmese government. A lot of that's to do with the Burmese resources, and that's in many ways a competition between the United States and China. And in Syria, Russia's in there, not out of any great altruistic motive, but there because they have important bases and important investments. You know, the reason that we've been so feckless in Syria and haven't really taken a strong position is, one, the Israelis don't want the Muslim Brotherhood to take over, and two, we're not sure what to do. And I guess we don't have any resources at play in Syria.
Yeah, I think, the resource issue is certainly part of the entire puzzle. You can't deny that. On the other hand, the U.S. And the U.K. had made their peace with Gaddafi, and in fact, there were major players from the oil and gas industry there working with the Gaddafi regime. So certainly, it wasn't driven entirely by that. I mean, I think a lot of it had to do with the mercurial personality of Muammar Gaddafi himself. And in the case of Syria, it's clearly not a resource issue with Syria, but I think it is very much an issue of if Assad is gone, what comes in his place. I think that's a big concern, and people may not be happy with the Assad regime, but I think there's also a high degree of caution, of concern about what would follow his regime if he were toppled.
So, Scott Horton, again, professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. What do you make then of what these new sanctions against technology for Syria and Iran? We've got, I think that just in finishing up on the R2P issue, I think that President Obama is definitely thinking more in a 21st century way, isn't he? I mean, the strategic national security landscape changed so radically with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Forever, nation states have threatened each other, going back to the Greeks and the Romans. Now we have a completely different world in which nation states are very unlikely to go to war against each other, but subnational and transnational threats have taken over, and that most of what, the post-Cold War presidents have been stuck in the past. In many ways, they're still Cold War thinking. The Pentagon's still buying Cold War weapons. I think you got to give Obama a little bit of credit for at least thinking about how do you deal with these rogue actors who are murdering their own people without having to go to war against these countries, and the civilians in these countries are the collateral damage. That's what happened in the two wars against Iraq and so on.
I think that's exactly right, Ian. In fact, one thing I'll give Obama credit for is, his administration has very carefully studied the way these repressive regimes use technology, the way they use it against their civilian population, to spy on, to identify them, and eventually to arrest and torture people. And I think they're acting now to deny them the use of these technologies, that is, not allow them to be spread, and on the other hand, potentially to empower the population by ensuring that the population have continued access to social media, even when the governments try to shut that down. In fact, one thing we know now from the Libya conflict is that while Gaddafi tried to shut down internet access, the U.S. apparently was there in Libya surreptitiously setting up an internet access system for people to use.
So if this is to work, then this new proposal of the president's announced yesterday at the National Holocaust Museum, if this is to work against Iran and Syria, to some extent, the barn door's open and the horse is down the paddock. A lot of technology that has been on the market. Does that mean that the U.S. government's going to be applying sanctions? Because the people who supply, you know, the sophisticated internet equipment to monitor our Silicon Valley companies and companies in Israel and in Europe.
I think they are going to be restricting sales. But, of course, they have competition. It's not just Silicon Valley. I mean, there are also German manufacturers and software providers. And China has emerged in this area as a very important presence.
Well, China has a huge portfolio domestically of keeping its own people off the internet and censoring them and watching them. And they even have this huge cadre of 50-cent citizens who blog for the government and create government polls. And one of the great ironies was recently when the SOPA Act came up, the Stop Online Piracy Act here in the U.S. Congress, we had Hollywood versus Silicon Valley. And lo and behold, the bill that Hollywood had put forth with the former senator from Connecticut as the front man would basically employ the technology that China has used against its own citizen and against piracy in this country. They were forced to strip that out of the bill.
That's right. And the Chinese have been marketing this technology to authoritarian nations with which they have friendly relations. We know that's been going on, too. But, you know, one thing I think we can say is that these technological innovations make it much easier to make a record of atrocity crimes, of attacks on civilians, on abuse of civilians. Almost everyone who has a phone now has a camera in the phone and the capability to take pictures and send them out of the reach of the local tyrants. And that can create a record that can be used at some point in the future. And I think this potentially is a very, very powerful tool that can be used by human rights advocates who will say that, well, it may well be that we can't do anything about this dictatorship and what it's doing today, but the time will come when we will be able to push for accountability, and these technologies will provide the evidence that can be used in the future.
Well, apparently the U.S. has already has drones over Syria documenting human rights abuses.
Exactly. In fact, there's been a proposal to strengthen this use of drones for human rights purposes out there for some time. Right now, it's American intelligence agencies that use it. There's been a suggestion: why shouldn't human rights monitors have access to this drone technology and use it directly? And I think that time will come too.
So, Scott Horton, again, professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. Yesterday, I talked to somebody who was at the Holocaust Museum when the president made those remarks and was formerly with the UN Human Rights Commission. And, of course, the head of the UN Human Rights Commission, she's been very outspoken against the Assad regime and the torturing of children in front of their parents and the hideous stuff that's going on in Syria. And she's called for the Assad clan to be referred to the International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, of course, Kofi Annan, the former head of the UN, is in trying to make a deal with Assad via the Russians. So there's a two-track thing going on there. But one of the words that came up in that conversation yesterday was the word human protection, as though we already have a new bureaucracy, the human protection. In other words, we now have people in the human protection business. I don't mean to be cynical, but it just felt to me like maybe, you know, everything ends up being a bureaucracy.
Even within NATO, we know now that they're embracing a protection function as part of the doctrine, as what NATO forces are trained to do and what they, in fact, have done in important campaigns. In the case of Libya in particular, now in the NATO training schools where they have officers from other nations around the world, including authoritarian governments, present, they teach them about the protection function. I think a lot of these people must sit there and think, you know, my own government could wind up being the subject of such an operation, and I could be right in the middle of it if I'm executing my government's orders to fire upon civilians. So I think it's really turning things around quite dramatically, and I think this is a positive development.
So that's, I guess, links up with what the president said yesterday, that sovereignty can no longer be an excuse for murdering your own people.
I think that's right, that there is this value of protecting individuals, and that we will not allow governments to brutalize their populations.
So do you think then that there will be some kind of linkage then between, I suppose this, what we're talking about here with R2P and the idea of having drones flying over Syria is a sort of extension of what they call soft power, means to persuade, is there, in other words, non-military ways of getting rid of murderous tyrants without going to war against their people? You know, on the other hand, you have the International Criminal Court, which the U.S., by the way, has not signed on to. They've indicted a few people, like Omar Bashir, the leader in Sudan, who's now waging war against the South. He's all but declared war against the South. He's running free. Assad's running free. How do you assess the chances of moral suasion and soft power working?
I think that when the entire international community speaks with one voice, it can be very powerful and very effective. And I think even short of that, when the great powers speak with one voice, it can be very effective. The problem, I think, comes when we have a split amongst the great powers, and we have some standing to the side and being quiet or actually supporting a dictator. And I think that's, what we've seen in the case of Syria, where we had, China and Russia not supporting sanctions or measures in the Security Council. And then I think the international community's voice is weakened.
But isn't the reason for these splits, I think, at least that was my what I offered earlier, Scott, is that it's a lot to do with resources.
It's also traditional interests. So mm-hmm. I think, Russia has viewed Syria as part of its sphere of influence for many decades now, and I think was resentful of the idea of American encroachment. But I'd say even within Russia now, if you follow the discussion of these matters in the Russian media, you see that there's some sensitivity, some embarrassment even over the fact that Russia was blocking all this. And I think this is the reason why you see Lavrov go down to Syria and press the need for a ceasefire. And I think that again shows that the dynamics of international condemnation definitely have some effect.
But it seems to me that on the we talked about the European left earlier, and to some extent the American left, and certainly here at Pacifica, you have a constituency of people who see Gaddafi as a hero, the Assads as heroes, and particularly worship Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez. And Hugo Chavez, of course, his foreign policy has been to go out of his way to support Ahmadinejad when he was beating up on his own people and suppressing the Green Revolution. Now he's supplying oil to Assad. It used to be that the American left and the European left had a conscience, and they were the ones that were the champions of human rights in El Salvador and Nicaragua and countries like that. But now they seem to be making apologies for these strutting, egotistical dictators.
Well, I think most of what's going on is sort of a negative reaction to American militarism and American internationalism and a desire to oppose more projection of American power against the background of these recent wars. But the bottom line is that these sorts of analyses are remarkably weak. They don't really understand what's going on to the average person on the ground in Iran or in Syria, where the level, these are classic police states where there's a tremendous amount of brutality, torture, harshness in prisons, no serious or fair justice system in either country. So it's ruled by violence by a small clique. The Assads were portrayed as being progressive and having a vision for their country and being tolerant. I think, their characterization just doesn't stand up, particularly in light of what's gone on in the last several months, where we've seen the brutal real face of the Assad regime come out.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Scott Horton.
It's great to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton. He's a professor at the Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The headline written down.